You are listening to the Heavenly Chi podcast, episode number 82. Today, I am joined by Jack Sloan-Lees again, and we have a special guest today, Lois Nethery. She is an amazing practitioner. I'm going to let Jack introduce all of the wonderful things about her.
Thanks, Claire. So for those who don't know Dr. Lois Nethery, she's a classical Chinese medicine practitioner with over 20 years of experience who practices out of the Village Healing Centre in Curl Curl, New South Wales. And she works with everything from complex health conditions to mental health and trauma, all through a really grounded, somatic and Taoist-based lens. Lois has this really beautiful way of helping people see their symptoms not just as problems to fix, but as meaningful signs from the body-mind. Her work weaves together Chinese medicine, trauma awareness, and big questions about how we make sense of the world. In this episode, we're going to be picking Lois's brain as we dive into how mental health, mental and spiritual health play a role in healing, what it does to treat, what it means to treat trauma through a Chinese medicine framework, and why acupuncture can feel so quietly life-changing. So welcome, Lois. We're so excited to have you here.
Thank you so much. Hi, Claire. Hi, Jack. I'm very happy and excited to be here on your beautiful podcast. Thank you for the lovely introduction as well.
It's such a pleasure to have you here. If I might ask the first question, I'd like to start by kind of getting a big picture overview of how it is you work. How does and how mental, emotional, and spiritual health have come to take such a central place in your clinical practice? Was there a turning point for you, and what sparked your interest in this?
I think it just came about because I like to listen, and I realized that just over time, part of that listening was also listening to the signals that were coming from the body as a kind of a language. So there's what the patients are saying with their words, there's what they're doing with their actions, the choices that they make, but also the what we call symptoms or sensations from the body were actually creating like a meaningful, like a warp and weave, if that's the word, warp and weft. Part of their experience, it was, and sometimes the signal seemed to be really quite insistent. And I was finding that it was feeling not good to me as a practitioner to make those signals become quiet. I didn't feel in myself that I was doing the person justice. It didn't feel really like treatment. Even though sometimes people would say they wanted the signal to go away, and considering that to be good treatment, there was something missing. And so I came across different kinds of thinkers because I just, I get curious and I just like to read and find different ways of how other people see things. And probably one of the biggest turning points was many years ago when I read a book called Dream Body by Arnold Mindell. So he was a Jungian therapist who listened to people's dreams, and then he would notice that they had body symptoms that seemed to be speaking the same language as the dreams. And he developed an approach called process-oriented psychology, I think it's called, which is really fascinating, and it's a way of allowing the sensation or the signal from the body, for example, neck pain. In the West, we would tend to stretch against tightness, you know, try and stretch it and almost say to that signal that it's incorrect, that the neck should be over here, so we stretch away from it. And his approach did the opposite. It's like, okay, well, what if it's calling that ear down to meet that shoulder? What happens then? And his approach became quite intricate and just very interesting, the insights that people would come to when they were supported to make the shape that that signal was calling their body to make. And so they would go into that shape, and then there would be an insight there which couldn't really be predicted ahead of time what that insight might be. So from that, I guess one of the a big message that I learned to appreciate was that the body is always being very kind. It's this beautiful ally. Even in the midst of very difficult sensations and symptoms, the body is trying to align with and ally with the spirit, the mind, the emotions, the person's life curriculum. And from there, I've just continued to, I guess, live my life and be a practitioner, but things come across my view that excite me. So it became richer when I discovered, you know, Peter Levine's work and with somatic experiencing. And there are plenty of people who have a similar approach. But, yeah, just the beauty of it and not knowing what's going to happen when you start listening to that signal. It in internal family systems, which is another framework, they call it a trailhead, which is a really beautiful phrase. It's like this, a signpost that says you could go down here, and then it becomes a path, which is an unfolding. Yeah.
I love all that, and I love the way in which it has the ability to be empowering for patients and to put them back into the driver's seat, that their symptoms and the discomfort that they feel in their body, it's not their body being naughty or misbehaving or intentionally trying to create problems for them. It's an invitation. It's could be the beginning of a conversation with the body. And I love that the assumption is, well, you know, it's an invitation, and what happens if you accept the invitation and follow through with that? I really like that frame.
Yeah. That's right. It's it comes from this sort of core assumption that the body is trying to be good, and not being naughty, not rebelling, and not trying to harm the person. Because in the midst of a health crisis, it certainly can feel that way. And our culture hasn't got great narratives and frameworks, not in popular culture anyway, to embrace that. It might come along as a tantalizing idea, but then when the pain hits, or the nausea or whatever it is that the person's struggling with, it's like that generosity towards the body is very hard to muster, because the discomfort itself centers itself, you know. So, yeah, patients do, over time, once, you know, they like the idea of it, and then they feel the pain, and then it's like, oh, maybe that's gobbledygook. It feels too incongruous. It's like that can't be good. A fundamental part of being alive is being averse to pain and being attracted to pleasure, and that's supposed to help us orientate through the world. So when something is noxious or painful, but then it's also helpful, that it's quite hard to understand at first. So it definitely, not that there's a right and a wrong way to do it, but there's a supportive and an unsupportive way to be with that idea, I guess. It takes a lot of sensitivity. It's very important to validate the discomfort and the pain that the person is in, and help them understand that you recognize that it's real, before or at the same time as giving them the opportunity to explore the possibility that this is something that's actually happening. It's trying to be good. It's trying to help them. Mm. Yeah. Some patients just flow into it and they just eat it up. And for other patients, it takes quite a lot of hand-holding and very, very gentle tiptoe steps towards them really having an experience of that, so that they say, yes, that I get it now. I I don't have to believe you. I can feel that that's true. Yeah.
And I can imagine it would be quite challenging for practitioners, especially with a lot of our training being focused on this idea that the perfect person doesn't get sick and the perfect person doesn't have symptoms. And if you could just be perfect, you know, if you could just be better at all of your self-care and better at eating the right foods and better at going to bed on time and doing all the things, then you won't have symptoms. And so I think there's a lot of practitioners who'd probably be listening to this thinking, well, how would I even start this way of thinking? Because it's almost like we first need to be able to sit with the discomfort and to sit in the pain and the suffering with patients to be able to support them through that, rather than to think, okay, well, I've got to put in needles for this and I've got to adjust the herb formula for that and make some recommendations here. Like, is that part of the instinct that practitioners need to pay attention to? How does that work?
Oh, I think there are so many parts to that question. I think it's a great question, and I think a lot of people would really relate to that. And part of that comes back to, and I don't want to tell any other practitioner what their job is, because each practitioner gets to decide, like, what's my job in relation to the patient? But it is like, it's not a tightrope in the sense, it's just, how do I both like give space for the complexity of this person's lived experience in this moment and how it's impacting them, and at the same time carry an optimism? Maybe that's part of the key, is just having this optimism that it will resolve, even if at the moment it feels confusing. Because sometimes even when I'm thinking about this, like, for example, if I'm trying to write something that's conveying my work to prospective patients, I find it really difficult to put into words, because sometimes it sounds like, what, are you going to be sitting on your hands and just allowing a person to wallow in what's happening to them, or even glorifying pain? Or, you know, it's very easy to just slightly get off the path of what this way of practicing actually is, where it does become a bit skewed and unbalanced. I don't think that it's for everybody. Like, I don't think that every practitioner would want to work in this way, and that's okay. There are practitioners who really enjoy somebody coming in with a painful body part, and then they palpate, and then they might do local treatments or distal treatments, and then that person feels comfortable and they've got their range of motion back in a handful of sessions, and for them that's like, that is the pinnacle of their practice, and they should be very proud to practice that way. I think it's, and there are patients that really want that experience. So those practitioners do not want patients to cry, you know, for example. you know, they don't want them to talk about their feelings, and their patients probably don't want to talk about their feelings or what's going on in their life outside of the painful body part and how it impacts the activities that they can do. And that's okay. Like, those patients are really happy with those practitioners. Like, that's a beautiful match. And part of it is sort of as our identity as a practitioner, like, it's sort of owning the space that we inhabit ourselves, like, based on our own quirks and gifts And quite often our gifts are the things that we don't really see because they are quite easy. And I find that with practitioners, that can be one of the hardest things, is defining who they are as a practitioner and what they have to offer, because they don't really, a lot of practitioners aren't really able to see themselves from the outside, in my experience. So they look at what other practitioners are doing and how other people practice, and they think, oh, should I be doing that? Should I be doing that? Should I be like that? Am I doing it wrong? So, yeah, if people have a curiosity about this and if that lights them up, then it's a beautiful avenue to explore. But I'm not sure that it's for everyone. Did that even answer your question? I can't remember what you asked me, but
I think it perfectly does. I think it perfectly does. You know, you've described that we are all unique. You know, this idea that it's not an accident that a particular patient ends up in your practice at a particular point in their life, at a particular season in their life, because you're the practitioner that they need in that moment in their life. And at a different point in their life, they might be experiencing life in a different way where they just want to get on with it. Mm. And they don't want to spend the time going deep and exploring. They just want to sort out their period pain or their sore back or their headaches and then get on to the next thing and maybe come back and revisit a deeper experience at another point in their life, or maybe not.
Yeah.
You know, we're all different. We're all different. We're all unique. And I really like the way that you say that it's not for all practitioners. You know, this is not an invitation to go to another technique seminar or, you know, to explore a new avenue of CPD education, that it's something that you couldn't, that if you feel congruent with it, that you could add some of these ideas to the way that you think about your way of practicing with patients or not. This just might be an interesting episode that you listen to and then you just listen to the next one.
Yeah. And for those people that do feel their ears pricking up and do feel that curiosity or that stirring, I hope it is a permission slip that there is at least one other practitioner who is working in this way. And I know that there are more. I know that there are practitioners who are actually qualified as somatic experiencing practitioners and also Chinese medicine. So, yeah, it's definitely, we're definitely out there. and it's definitely a legitimate way to work. And I guess it's sort of, you know, if you're curious about it and open to it, it's probably how you're going to be adding value. And that's kind of a phrase that's helpful to me. It's like, as a person, as a practitioner, with your interests and the things that you're finding that you do well, it's like that's how you kind of figure out where you add value. And I guess I'm curious, Claire, like what would you say is like your special sauce, like your mix of interests and skills? Like where do you, what would you say that you add value?
It's a good question. I often reflect on this. I think I have an endless curiosity and that leads me down very deep intellectual rabbit holes, and it also sends me down very deep spiritual rabbit holes and also psychological rabbit holes, I guess. And so I've done, you know, 2.5, 3 years of NLP training. I've done a 2.5 year yoga teacher training that was all focused on the Yoga Sutras. I've done just about every technique seminar you can think of. I've done deep training in lots of things, and I guess I'm always looking for the connections because I want to be able to find the connections that are relevant to my patients. So I don't know. I think people are sometimes surprised when I come out with sentences like, you know, as you were talking about before, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I do often talk to my patients, and not everyone, only certain patients, where we'll have conversations like, what is the body trying to, you know, what is your body trying to do here? Like, imagine if this was for a good purpose, what would be the purpose of these headaches, or what would be the purpose of whatever it is that's going on? And those conversations often lead to really good, you know, really good interactions and experiences for patients. But I don't have those conversations with everyone. Sometimes we're sticking at that, you know, we're just talking about the data. We're talking about the numbers and the blood tests. And I guess I'm thinking about all of those things in the background. I don't even know if that's an answer to the question that you asked me, but it's hard to answer. You know, like, you've been practicing for a couple of decades. I've been practicing for a couple of decades, and I've definitely changed and evolved as a practitioner over that time. And I've definitely have a lot more nowadays, a lot more acceptance and loving of my patients for their starting point and working with them in the ways in which they want to and are ready to. And so I think that that's, but I mean, I don't put that on my website or on a brochure. I think you can. Yeah.
It's very hard to put certain things into words. I had someone say to me, oh, I'm really glad that you didn't put everything that happens in the room. Like, I'm really glad that I didn't know, because I probably wouldn't have come in. It's like going to a restaurant and you look at the menu outside, and then you come in and then you see the specials board, which I thought was a beautiful analogy. But it's getting that balance of, like, how to let people understand what's possible while making it sound normal. Not woo-woo, not trying to be fancy.
Yeah. And I think, people often just say, you know, I just feel better. Like, even working with patients over telehealth, I haven't done anything physical with them, but just having these interactions. But I'm curious to know, Jack, because you're new. You've been, it's your first 12 months as a new practitioner, and I know there's lots of students and new practitioners who listen as well. And if I reflect back on how I was thinking about this type of question, you know, how would I have thought about this type of question as a new practitioner? I don't know. I think it would have been a very different answer. I'm just wondering what your reflections are so far, Jack.
Yeah, I think I'm still figuring the answer to that out as well. I'm, especially since I'm transforming, is the word that comes to mind, from a massage therapist into a full-time Chinese medicine practitioner at the moment. And so I'm going from working with pain almost exclusively to, I don't know, I have a funny relationship with treating pain with Chinese medicine. I don't know why. I don't know what that's about yet, but I don't enjoy it that much. But interestingly, it's funny that you were talking before, Lois, about how there are some people you can go a bit deeper with, and that you can kind of explore those deeper layers of things. And the really interesting thing I've noticed about treating pain with Chinese medicine for me is, if I have someone who is A, willing to go that little bit deeper, and B, if I can be in the flow enough to grab those little pieces and, like, listen to those little signs when they when they're there and follow that curiosity with them, those people, their pain goes away and doesn't come back. But with other people who I like, it's seemingly pretty straightforward. I don't know. I just kind of struggle with it. And so I have this really interesting relationship with treating pain at the moment. I was kind of struck by the similarity to an idea I encountered somewhat recently, actually reading a little bit about five element theory, reading about that a little bit more deeply, trying to find some answers to my own clinical struggles, shall we say. And the idea of being able to identify not just the like constitutional factor, but like which element is or which phase is probably more a more like appropriate word, is like is presenting and most alive in the person that's in the room with you, and matching that with the controlling element. And I'm thinking of one patient in particular who was very much was very stressed, very clear, like liver qi stagnation type pattern, and who was just not really getting a lot out of just the acupuncture, and was somewhat blunt about that. I was like, that's okay. And I think I went, I just followed my curiosity into what I feel like on reflection was just going into a bit of the metal element, and just really broke down the reasons why it wasn't working after I found out what the reason, like some of the other factors involved, and just got really specific and kind of cut through the noise a little bit. And was very like methodical about this is why this is happening and putting all those pieces in place. And literally the next time I saw her, her pain had almost disappeared completely. And it was just really interesting noticing that there was almost this sense that I kind of realized, and I've had that multiple times, that I could put kind of all the needles in that I wanted. I could empty my needle box, and it's not necessarily going to make any more difference than being present with the person and their pain and what's going on for them. And yeah, following that thread to where it's really coming from. So I guess like in a way, this way of practicing, I think, resonates with me, at least in the context of treating pain. But it's challenging because it's I don't know if I would describe it as a tightrope either, but there's a fine balance to be met there, and pushing too hard or like flowing too far in one way or the other upsets that balance. And you kind of, I don't know, at least for me, I feel like I lose that thread, at least temporarily.
Yeah, that's beautifully described. Part of it is that I guess it's I guess sort of a dance, like the person needs to be with you in what's happening, and it can be it's possible to get out of step with them, and so they're not with you in that anymore. Part of that is the power of a framework, as you mentioned, with the five phases. Like that's a framework that's really spoken to you, and then you've been able to apply that to an encounter with a patient. And part of it is consent. And sometimes I will verbally say to somebody if I sense that going into a more esoteric way of being with them is going to feel threatening, I'll just give them the option. I'll say, I can feel your pulses and that's going to give me all the information I need to give you a really good treatment, and I can tell you what I feel, and I can give you a narrative of what's coming up in the pulses so that you understand it on that sort of conceptual level. Or we can do like an exploration of the sensation and see everyone, and then just let them, you know, a person can just tell you what they're comfortable with and what they're not comfortable with. But there's also, you know, that kind of implicit consent that you, that conversation that you had with the patient, that would patient, where you were finding a relational frame that was going to be helpful to them, drawing on the framework of the five elements. But then it's almost like, okay, if I speak to you in this way, is it going to be comfortable for you? You know, so you try it on, and then the person relaxes, or they open up and they start telling you more, or you know, whatever it is that happens. It's like, okay, well, that was the right step in that dance with that patient. And so, yeah, that sort of issue of consent is in the conversation that we have with them as well. It's like, the way I'm talking, are you comfortable with this? Is the way I'm explaining things to you, is it landing? And then it's also about what, when we go to actually do the treatment, there's consent there as well. But it's so easy to forget as a practitioner how vulnerable it is to be open, not just physically, like getting a massage, but acupuncture is, you know, we go down to the yuan qi, we go into the wei qi and the yin qi. And yeah, just being super, super respectful. And it's like walking that, or carrying that balance between subjectivity and objectivity. Like all of our frameworks, yin yang, five phases, six spheres, they give us these lenses where we can look at the sort of chaos that the patient is feeling, and we can have this sort of calmness of objectivity and making concise something which seems chaotic. But at the same time, as a Chinese medicine practitioner, our subjectivity is so important, so that the person feels our presence, as you were saying, that the presence is part of our special sauce that we offer to people. It's quite a unique space, but that's part of the challenge of being a Chinese medicine practitioner, is no one can tell you how you do you in that space. Yeah, after 1 year, you're learning some great stuff by the sounds of things.
Slowly but surely, I'm not quite at the 1 year mark. I'm still in that first year. So,
yeah.
Thankfully, I am a lifelong learner, and so I have no doubt that that will continue well into the future. I'd love to know a little bit too, because you are a classical acupuncture or classical Chinese medicine practitioner, I believe. Does the way that you approach some of these like deeper psychological life curriculum type patterns and syndromes that you see people presenting in clinic with, do you utilize tools like the low vessels and the divergent channel treatments and 8 extra channels, or do you have another, is there another mechanism or another style that you use for this?
Yeah, I do. Since learning that approach, you know, as taught by Jeffrey Yuan, as brought to Australia first by Anne Cecil Sturman, or, you know, that's the way I sort of was taught in person at first, doing pulses and then sinews with her, and also some divergence and the lows from Sean Tootin. Definitely I would say that those in technical terms, they are a big part of my practice. It's mostly what I draw on. But sometimes I'll do a really simple primary channel treatment because that's what that person needs. Sometimes the consultation has done the majority of the work and the acupuncture treatment is a confirmation of what was just spoken. So, yeah, but I'm very much informed by that. I don't know, you can't call it really a lineage or an approach. I don't know what to call it. And I know that the term classical acupuncture or classical Chinese medicine is a little fraught. So I don't know what term to use, but yeah, that if Chinese medicine is a country, then I would say that province is where I spend most of my time. I find it really rewarding, and it's very comprehensive in terms of meaning making. So because I've learnt through that, or in that province, I've learnt mediumship, you know, like how we make it, the different kinds of it, what they're used for, how mediumship helps us to meet the challenges of life. And, you know, even just learning that, just tied together so many parts of what you call TCM that comes across as being holistic, but in my experience was still more fragmented than what I had expected. And so what I found in this province where I spend a lot of time is that there's so much context where all of these concepts of Chinese medicine become embedded in this sort of living matrix. So you can be very dynamic. It allows me as a practitioner to find plain English to talk to my patients, not only about what's going on in a very mundane way, in a practical way, about their health challenges, but to be able to, you know, start a sentence in a very mundane place and finish up in a deeply inspiring, spiritually uplifting place. And I find that that province contains so many connections between all of these different concepts of Chinese medicine in a way that allows moving through that matrix to be quite straightforward and dynamic and can respond to that particular patient. Like it's such a joy to be able to tell somebody something about what's going on with them, and they relax and their eyes light up and their eyes go a bit moist. And they say, where can I read more about this? It's like, I don't know. That's the beauty of one-on-one practice. You get, it's like, what's this one little nugget that's going to really connect with that person? And now they see themselves really, really differently. Like there's so much hope in it.
I wonder, Lois, if you'd be able to explain mediumship the way that you understand it. Not everyone knows what mediumship means.
Yeah, okay. The way I understand it, and that's a great way of phrasing it because I don't claim to have any authority on this. I definitely class myself as a student. So it's essentially, if you like, life, a living form is form that is animated from within by a movement. So in our living body, it's actually fluids. So every cell is made of a bunch of different kinds of fluids, lipids and watery fluids, and they contain each other. And even bone is actually just made of cells. So, you know, the living body is all of these compartments of fluid that are animated. So if there's no animation, then that fluid is not alive. If there's no form and no fluid, then that animation, it's not a living form, it's something else. So that's the starting place. And then what we need to do as a vessel for our consciousness or our spirit is we need to be able to take from our surroundings and bring them in and do this sort of alchemy to continue to create more form. And that's the incredible power of the stomach and the digestive system, which we just don't think about. Like, you can turn an apple into bone and liver without thinking, like, without it, you just eat an apple and there it is. It's now it's your body. Like, we do magic every day. I think it's wonderful. And then, so there are just different, you could say, frequencies of that form, like very thick and slow, replete with information is the hormones, or even more slow and replete with information is the Jing essence. And then really thin and more functional is like the sweat and the tears and so on. So those are different kinds of mediumship. So it covers Jin Ye and blood and what else? What am I missing?
Yin.
Yin, thank you. yeah, it covers those different things and it wraps them all together into this one meta concept, which is extremely helpful because as a vessel, you know, we're going through life just expressing who we are, and then the world around us is being what it is. And, you know, there can be some interference patterns with that. And this is how I explain it to patients, and people will get it. Like, patients really understand it most of the time. So if movement is coming towards us from the outside, as in yang, and that movement, when it comes into and starts moving with the movement inside of our body, if that external movement is not going to expand and harmonize like a harmonic, you know, it's not going to expand and make better our movement from internally, then we say it's cold. Whereas if it comes in and it's going to just enhance and harmonize with and make better what we're already doing, then it's warm. So if it's coming towards us and we just let it move around within us, it's going to not be us anymore. It's not our expression. It's something else. It's foreign and tricky. It doesn't make it bad. It's just wrong for us. So the body needs to grab some of this form, wrap it up and make it go quiet. So it's like the water trigram with the broken lines, the yin broken lines, top and bottom, and then the solid yang line in between. It's like that's how things are when they're good. And then if something's coming towards us and it's cold, we still need to just wrap up and make it go quiet using some yin, wrap up that yang and make it go quiet. Is that clear?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, gosh. and so taking that the next step, what you're implying is that when we're well resourced and our mediumship is adequate to support us and sustain us to be able to do all of the things we want to and need to be able to do, then when life comes at us, which it does, unrelentingly so, if we're well resourced, then we're able to manage these challenges that come our way. And then depending on the size of the challenge or depending on how well resourced we are, we may not be able to mount a sufficient response to deal with the life that comes at us.
Yeah, definitely. That's like a quantitative way of looking at it, and it's true quantitatively. I guess the mediumship has to be in the right place at the right time. There's such a thing as too much mediumship, or too much of the wrong kind in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. It's that constant dichotomy when often there's yin deficiency and dampness coexisting. It's just a matter of which part of the body are we looking at.
That lives in my brain in a good way.
Yeah.
Your concept of damp being fake blood, I love that.
Yeah.
It's such a succinct description. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's like this other layer, which is, you know, probably for most of us, aspirational of, like, as a Taoist medicine, we've got this ideal, perfectionistic, aspirational point to kind of, it's a practice, right, to practice towards with our cultivation and all the rest of it, of harmony, you know, being in harmony with the world. This is what I think about when I'm washing the dishes, things like this. It's like the more harmonious we can be with the world, or within, or, you know, within ourselves and with the world, then perhaps the less likelihood that what comes towards us is cold in nature, because we're able to harmonize. As again, it's like aspirational. I don't even hold myself to that standard. Like, it, you know, I think that, like, I practice just understanding that that's, you know, that that's the teaching.
Yeah.
And certainly don't hold patients to that standard, or anyone. Yeah.
No, I like that you emphasize practice, you know, the word practice. And there's at least one, if not two, episodes that I've recorded with Sean Tootin, and I love his self-confessed medical nihilism. You know, we're all doomed, basically. Yes. Says it with such uplifting pessimism. But, you know, one of the things that he says, which I really love, and it's been helpful for me, and I've shared it with others, it's been helpful with them too, is this idea that we call it practice because none of us are nailing it.
Mm-hmm.
None of us are nailing it. We're practicing.
Absolutely. It's such a permission slip to just do your best.
Yep.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
You look around, it's like, oh, actually, that's true. That's all that anyone is doing.
Yep.
It doesn't make it easy, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, Claire and Jack, like, as a health practitioner, particularly natural health, maybe particularly where it's sort of energetic-based or energy-based, there can be this pressure to, well, I can't get sick, or I can't have health problems, acute or chronic, because that means dot, dot, dot. You know, it's what about if we're practicing with our own body as well and figuring stuff out? Like, that doesn't make a health practitioner less valuable. And, in fact, a practitioner that is really intimate with the struggle of chronic health is, and this is another analogy I use for patients, and so I'll just share it in case anyone wants to share it with their patients too, because people get it. If you're going to go on a hike and you've got a choice of two, and it's a really hard hike, and you've got a choice of two guides to go with, and one of them's got really shiny shoes and a brand new backpack, and they're really clean shaven and their skin's really soft, and then the other one's like got leathery skin and their backpack's beaten up and their shoes have seen a lot of action, it's like, you know which guide you're going to choose. And I would love health practitioners to take that on board, and you know, the nuance that you have through living through something difficult with your own health can give you the information that's so valuable to the patient. It's like, oh, do you know what, like, if you've got pain at bedtime and you're worried that it's going to impact your sleep and you're going to be up till 2 a.m. try dot, dot, dot. You know, like, you can offer them something very specific and practical that can be an absolute game changer. So, yeah, I think that we can own our struggles personally as human beings, as well as owning the struggle of trying to help other people, or owning the practice of that struggle. I think it's all okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's such an unrealistic expectation that we have of ourselves as health practitioners, that we can't be sick, we can't be unwell. I have quite a few practitioners of various modalities who see me as patients, and And they don't come when they're feeling amazing. They're coming when they're suffering. And having that additional layer of guilt and shame layered on top of what for anyone else would be just, and I'm using air quotes here, just the illness. But when you've got your illness and then you've got this extra layer of guilt and shame over it, it creates so much unnecessary suffering. And part of the journey for the practitioner, they, you know, they come out the other side feeling so much more empowered and so much more accepting. And, you know, often they'll report that they feel like they're a better practitioner for having gone through this process of being okay with being unwell. It's a universal thing. You know, to be alive is to suffer, as the Buddhists would say. But this, you know, this idea of suffering is not something that we're immune to because we have Chinese medicine. And I guess that, you know, coming back to that, what you were saying at the start, that when we're suffering and, you know, when you're in that pit of despair, there's no ladder that can get you out. You don't climb your way out rung by ring, rung by rung. You're in this timeless space that feels like it will never end, and it feels like you could potentially die from the immense suffering that you're experiencing. And then at some point in the future, you'll magically teleport out, and then you're not in the suffering anymore. And it's like a magical teleportation, because it's very... I don't think I've met anyone that has this conscious, you know, I climbed out rung by rung and my suffering, it's like this magic teleportation. But when you're in it, there's, if you have the skills or the guidance from others, or, you know, some ability to make, to find meaning and to work out what is the point of these suffering, then I think that's where we have the opportunity to become, to grow. And as practitioners, if we can see our own illnesses as an invitation to grow, or whatever it is that the invitation is, that can help us.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, coming out the other side of experiences like that, there's a natural humility to it. It's sort of coming out with some scuff marks and scars to show for it.
Yeah.
Looking around and going, oh, there's a bunch of people here with scuff marks and scars. And there's that beautiful little short film by Brené Brown about empathy, where she has someone down that dark hole that you describe. And I think it's like sympathy is calling down from up the top saying, I'm really sorry that you're down there. And then empathy is somebody saying, I can't remember in her film if they actually come down the ladder and sit with the other person and say, I've been down this hole, like I've had my own experience down this hole. So as a practitioner who's had health struggles, you get to be that kind of person, and it's incredibly powerful for someone to feel not alone in where they're at. In itself is a kind of a medicine, like a really good medicine. You don't have to have had the same thing that they've got. It's just having been to that place yourself, and then, as you say, like, and then at some point in the future the sun's still shining and it's like, oh, look at that,
I'm not in there anymore.
Yeah. There's two analogies I find that are helpful to normalize it for people who are in it, I have had feedback that they find very helpful. One is I think some people might be familiar with the caterpillar. You know, the caterpillar goes into the cocoon and actually turns into this kind of goo before it becomes the butterfly. And that's a great one. That goo is just like, yep, like when is this going to take form? Like, you just have to wait for the process and then the form takes itself. And the other one is less common, but it's a different kind of struggle or a different kind of crisis. But when it fits, it's really applicable, and that's the lobster. So it's got an exoskeleton, but its soft body is always growing from the inside. And so it gets to a point where it's too tight, and it has to go under a rock, crack that exoskeleton off, and then it's got its new shell, but it's still a little bit soft. So it's got to wait under the rock for it to harden up, and then it can come out and swim around and lobster about. And that one, when people are feeling that constraint and stuckness and constraint and they don't know what's happening, it's not the goo. So, yeah, it's the goo or the lobster I find is super helpful.
There's also one of the mythology stories about Persephone and the underworld. And she gets married to Hades, the king of the underworld, through some kind of deal where she had to go down into the underworld. And she has to visit there, you know, periodically, has to go down into this space. And it's that metaphor for leaning into the discomfort, choosing the discomfort for the greater purpose.
Is she aligned to a star and she comes up periodically and it's about the harvest? She signifies the harvest.
Yeah. I'd have to brush up on my mythology stories.
I've got a really bad memory for that kind of thing.
Oh, same. But for anyone who's curious, I'm sure you could find an accurate retelling of the story and learn. I just know that it's related. It's related, yeah.
I'm fairly sure she is invited to the underworld and is tricked into eating something by Hades.
The pomegranate,
yeah. Uh-huh. And anything, if you eat anything in the underworld, then you are like forever bound to come back there or something to that effect. And her mother is like the goddess of summer and fertility and something like that. I can't remember what her name is, but that's how the seasons work. That's why we have summer and spring and autumn and winter, because autumn is when she leaves to go back to the underworld. And then spring is when she comes back up and her mother, the goddess of life, is happy again.
Mm-hmm. Look at that. Look at us. We piece together. We pieced it together.
How many Chinese medicine practitioners does it take to piece together one Greek myth?
Three.
You know, it's interesting that has, I mean, maybe the original myth didn't have the sort of light, positive and negative frame that we put on it. Like, winter is bad, that fallow state is bad, and then the harvest and the spring and the summer is good. Maybe when they originally came up with it, it didn't have that connotation, because the Japanese do the cycles really beautifully. They've got that wabi-sabi idea of decay, like that decay going into that fallow state is considered aesthetically beautiful. And that's just such a beautiful remedy for our culture, which is really into the spring and the youth and the yang. And then when things turn and the leaves fall off in the autumn time, like, to still be happy and to still be appreciative as it turns and does that descent.
There's so many, you know, as you were speaking earlier, I was reflecting on the idea that when we are in places of adversity, you know, if we're unwell, if we're suffering through something, we don't tend to have very good social constructs around that and social practices. That if people are in hospital, for example, often people don't know what to do or what to say when someone's not well, and so they'll often just kind of self-select away and they'll wait until the person's better before they connect in again, or, you know, they just want to avoid those awkward moments because, what, you know, unless you're seasoned, well experienced at sitting with people who are in that space, you don't know what to say. Like, what's the right thing to say when someone is suffering? You know, especially, you know, I remember when my mum, she had terminal cancer, and in her last weeks, I remember speaking to a woman at the local op shop, as my mum had been volunteering there for a few years, and she rang to find out what was happening with mum. And I said, oh, she's, you know, she won't be able to come back in, you know, her health is declining and she doesn't have much longer to go. And she said, oh, I hope she feels better soon. And I just remember the discordance in that sentiment. You know, I know where it comes from, and it's very reactionary to say that when you hear that someone's not feeling well. But is that necessarily the right thing to say to someone in their final weeks of life? There's so, you know, it's almost like we need training on how to talk to people.
Yeah, we do. I have a friend who's actually involved, deeply involved with a movement. One of their key events is called Dying to Know Day. So they set up cafes and opportunities to come in and learn how to, as a community, how to gather around somebody who is getting ready to transition, pass away, you know, whatever language we want to use. Because we don't have great collective language or practices around that. And I think there comes a time where that optimism changes from being helpful to being invalidating or a barrier to intimacy. And it's really difficult to know that turning point for the person that you're wanting to express care for. Like, what are they wanting? Are they wanting my optimism, or are they wanting me to be with them now? Yeah.
Yeah, we could do with some upskilling as a society.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess these conversations are part of that upskilling.
Yeah.
One of the things that you talk about, if we looping back to this idea of mediumship and being able to face the challenges that come our way and how we respond to those challenges, and this idea of trauma as being something that happens when we face challenge in a particular way. Would you share your perspective on trauma, how you think about it through your Chinese medicine lens?
Yeah, I guess it's a really big topic, and I'm excited to see the changes in the Western approach over the past few decades. I think it's come a really long way, and I think it's been very affirming of some of the stuff that people have tried to say is important and, you know, has been sort of brushed away or invalidated, or, you know, it's like, I think the neuroscience of being able to do fMRI on the brain and see what happens is really, really important. It's a really useful contribution. So yeah, I guess it's like when something was too much to be dealt with in that moment, we still have to carry on. And so it has to kind of the impact of that has to be put somewhere. So, for example, from the perspective of the low vessels, like if something is sort of social, emotional in nature, that's really tricky, then the body can meet that vibration with blood, wrap it up, take it out of the primary channel, out of the present moment, and make it go quiet in like a swamp that surrounds the river of the primary channel, and tuck it away. So we can continue on. It's miraculous that we can go through things that are really challenging, not fully process them, but still be able to continue on. And then, if you've got a patient who identifies that they have got trauma, whether it's like CPTSD, like they've had a really difficult upbringing, or they've had one big T trauma event, and they're working with a talk therapist. As a Chinese medicine practitioner, you don't need, I don't think that you need to feel like you need to do a whole lot of specific training, because the talk therapist will be trained in understanding when it's safe to go into that sort of core place. And as a Chinese medicine practitioner, you can be supporting that patient beautifully in their body. So the talk therapist will be resourcing them with skills and social support and emotional regulation and so on before they actually touch into the core painful memories. And so as a practitioner, you can be supporting the body in building up resources, tonifying blood and just checking how's their blood, how's their digestion, how are their exit points, you know, can they release dampness and stagnation? and then if you wanted to, I believe that you could take a lingering pathogen approach as well. Not necessarily like goo or parasites specifically, but in the sense that this is something that the body has made latent, and when sufficiently resourced, it will come up and out and release. And that coming up and out might not be comfortable, but ultimately the person will feel more free once they've gone through that. And so we can feel pressure, I think, from ourselves as practitioners to try to move things, release, unblock, unstagnate, unobstruct too quickly. But sometimes it's just that giving the body the sense that it's being supported and that it has time is actually really, really helpful. I'm speaking vaguely in terms of protocols and that kind of, because people listening have all kinds of different provinces that they inhabit. So hopefully as a broad conversation, like people can think to their own approach and just see if that's a helpful. If they've been thinking, oh, I can't deal with people with PTSD because I don't have the training. It's like, well, maybe you can, with the right support from a therapist who knows what they're doing in sense of talk therapy. The main thing is just to get trauma informed, and you can probably find a 1-hour online training on just how to make somebody with PTSD feel safe as your patient, being very consistent, inviting collaboration, giving them choice. There's a bunch of principles that all start with a C. But, you know, once you've been practicing for a little while, you tend to have your muscle memory. You know, you greet the patient in the same way, you bring them into the room in the same way, they sit in the same chair, you do the consult in the same way, you feel the pulses in the same way. For me, I play the same music. The patients like it. So when something is different, you'll find that people with trauma or PTSD will notice the difference So keeping things as consistent as possible. And obviously another C word would be calm. But it's not that complicated to be trauma-informed, and I think it's useful to do that kind of training. And then we can be really, yeah, it can be a really helpful adjunctive treatment. You don't need to feel like you have to be a specialist or have special knowledge. You can use your tools and just be aware that first you're building up, and then when something's releasing, you're helping the body to release.
I love that. That's really beautiful. Is there anything when you are working with someone who has one of these, kind of more complex psychosomatic or psychosocial issues, is there anything are there any signs, or are there any specific markers that you look for or that you become aware of that someone may be ready to go a little bit deeper, or is that just a place that you don't go and you leave that completely in the realm with the talk therapist, or do you approach that in a different way from your Chinese medicine lens?
I've learned relatively recently a really beautiful, he calls them the inner laws of physics or something like that. Richard Schwartz, the guy that came up with internal family systems, that you can actually specifically request to any person's system that what you're going to do with them, that the system is not going to flood or overwhelm them. So if I have that relationship with the patient where we're working sort of as with body-mind kind of language and they're comfortable with that, I've learned that there are some patients who don't realise that they have that capability to be able to set the thermostat, as it were. And so as a practitioner who isn't trained to go really deeply into those core traumatic places, we just say that to the system. Because what we're conscious of is, it's like the iceberg, what we're conscious of is the little bit above the water, and what actually does a lot of the moving in our experience is the big part that's under the water. So we speak to the part that's under the water and we're just like, hey, could you please just, just do what's enough for today and make it comfortable and calm, and then, yeah, that the system complies. Yeah. And it's just understanding as a practitioner that it's, we don't have to do surgery for people. Do you know what I mean? To do a really, really good session, it doesn't need to be dramatic, in my opinion. A really good session is just what needs to happen that day. And sometimes that might just be holding Moxa against a point for quite a while and then doing a couple of other little bits and pieces, and that's the perfect thing for that person. Is that a good answer?
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that. It's very similar to some other things that I've learned, particularly in NLP and working with the unconscious and facilitating change at a deeper level, that is ecological and sustainable and as easeful as is possible. And I think it ties in really nicely with what you were talking about more, probably closer to the start of the episode with, the whole, all of the responses that are there in our body, if we're open to looking at it that way, are trying to be good. Mm-hmm. They're serving us in some way, even if they are deeply, deeply uncomfortable or unpleasant at times. There's something like it's not a rebellion or a sabotage. Like our body's not fighting against us. It's working towards something. And there's this understanding in there, I think, that, and in that frame, that's like, well, if it's working to my benefit, then there must be some way that I'm not, something that I'm not seeing about yet, about what that, what it is that that's trying to do or achieve, or what that is actually doing for me, whether it's something that I would identify as a thing I need or not. I'd love to know, though, and actually this, I will pass this question to you as well, Claire, because I'm sure, I imagine you've probably had some experience with this. What is your take on like healing crises and those other things that I guess I personally would put in the bucket of like a latent pathogen coming out of latency, when there can be that like unpleasant expulsion process? What is your take on that? And what is our role in, I don't know, facilitating and holding patients through that process if and when it happens?
My stance on healing crises has evolved over time, and where I stand with it now at this point is that most of the time, as the body's improving and as health is improving, symptoms are going to become less. And often if there is a healing crisis that comes up, it's going to be, like in the context of my clinic, it's going to be in the context of using the goo herbal formulas. And the way that I approach it is maybe different than what some other people might choose to follow, but typically I want to support the patient to stay within their ability to manage. And I guess it comes back to this idea of mediumship as well, that we can go in all guns blazing and, you know, smash out the highest full dose of the herbs, and the person can have a horrendous time of it, but we're getting it done, and they have 6 weeks of hell, and then they feel good. But it's come at such a cost that, to me as a clinician, I kind of, looking on, my thoughts are, was that worth it? And it takes so much management to be able to support someone through that. It takes a lot out of their life. It puts a big strain on their home life and their work life and their social life. And so because I prefer to practice really holistically, I don't like to go in with the all guns blazing approach. So I've seen people doing parasite cleanses, for example, with that triple antibiotic therapy. And what a lot of people describe when they go through that process is, it's very common that people will have intense suicidal ideation at some point during that process. And often that's a reflection of the intense amount of toxins that are produced by these creatures. And as they're dying, it all kind of gets dumped into the system. And, you know, the creatures are dying, and part of that energetic imprint is reflected in the physiology of the person, that they also feel like they're dying. And it's a very intense and uncomfortable process from all reports. I have not experienced it myself. But what I've found is that we can still get to the same outcome in a much more comfortable way, and in a way that's not so resource intensive, if we're willing to be more patient. And I love the way that the word patient is also the same as the word patient. Patient, the noun, and patient, the verb. And so I like to stay on the highest dose that we can do where the person remains symptom-free, as in free of the symptoms of a healing crisis, but also experiencing the changes and the benefits of being on the treatment and on the herbal formula. So that's my current stance, is that healing crisis is mostly a dosage issue. It's always hard to know for certain, is this a healing crisis, a true healing crisis, or did I get my diagnosis wrong? And I think that sometimes people are too quick to throw a healing crisis label onto a situation that could actually be incorrect treatment. So my first and foremost question that I'm asking, if someone's coming back to me saying, I don't feel great, these new symptoms have arrived, the first question that I'm asking is, have I got the right diagnosis and have I given the right treatment? Not, oh, this is a healing crisis, it will pass. And so there's that part of it. Very occasionally, I've had patients who, when it has been a healing crisis, a true healing crisis and not a diagnostic error or a treatment error on my behalf, that often what they will describe, when it's not at the crazy, you know, the 2 week program, when we're talking about a 6 month or a 12 month program, often the healing crisis, I've heard it described as, it's like every illness they've ever experienced at about 10% the intensity. And that to me sounds more like a true healing crisis, in the sense that we're kicking out these old patterns that the body has been resourced up to be able to finally evict these patterns that just don't work. They never did work. They were always held somewhere. And then the body finally has this invitation to go, right, here is the hard rubbish collection. We are chucking this out. So that's my current, that's the evolution as it stands for me in healing crisis.
I agree with that. Sometimes my patients are really generous and they might come and describe, you know, a new symptom and have an expectant smile in their face and say, is that a healing crisis? And we're like, well, that, you know, that's a beautiful sign of trust in our relationship, but I'm, you know, very open to wanting to know if that's something that I've caused by not having the formula correct. And so I'll just ask them to stop taking it for a few days and then start taking it again. And if the symptoms come back, then it's on me. And I agree with you that taking that longer view, part of it is about integration as well, so that the person can actually own the changes that are happening with them and that their new normal actually belongs to them and it doesn't belong to the practitioner. Because their health, with Chinese medicine being a body, mind, spirit paradigm, it's their relationship with their colleagues, with their family, with their friends, and how they dress, you know, like just so many aspects of their being might subtly change over that period of time where they're integrating that new normal, that it's respectful to allow a person to ease into that so that they can actually own it and it feels familiar to them. There's also like a, in the West, I find, and it's a similar thing with the detox people who are really passionate about detoxing and looking to do really harsh detoxes. There's this notion that there's something bad and that can be within and it must be purged so that the interior of the self is pure and this impurity is now outside of the self. And I guess that just sort of speaks to the Western notion of, well, a singular self for the start, where actually it's inside of us are these, we're well outnumbered with microbial passengers internally and externally in terms of number of cells. So we are an ecosystem and, yeah, that can get a bit out of balance. But I find that regenerative agriculture is a really great lens to for people to understand the difference. You know, weeds are just showing what's out of balance, and then we need to find out what the ecosystem needs, and then add time, and then you have a flourishing. And people can grasp that. Not everyone is up for that, and that's okay. Some people do want the dramatic thing, and some people value the crisis experience. I would say one time when it's not necessarily like a particularly bad thing is when you've been resourcing a patient and then they appear to catch a cold, but it doesn't really make sense that they've caught a cold. It seems a little out of place. And if you've had the opportunity to teach them what to do, and they've had a rest and they've had a big sleep and lots of clear fluids and all the rest of it, then they come out of that feeling much better and clearer. And as you say, something's been shaken off. And then it's an opportunity to say, well, actually, maybe the thing that happened from the outside was a catalyst and your body was opening up the doors, opening up the pores of the skin already, opening up the lung through the nasal passages. It was going to do that anyway, but it's had the opportunity to go in and into the cupboards and do a bit of a council cleanup, you know. and that's something that people can intuitively grasp as well. They're like, oh, that makes sense actually. Yeah, yeah. It's when you get that nod of recognition, like, oh, and they just, it lands and it's just like, okay, well, this is Chinese medicine. You know, it's not, you know, the less you use funny language and just use things in their lived experience, we can take our paradigm and just get them to really, really understand it. But yeah, in terms of the dramatic healing crisis, it's not something that I want for people. What about you, Jack, as an early career practitioner?
Yeah, I have a very similar, I have always had a very similar take on it. And I've actually taken a similar approach in my massage because I did very deep tissue myofascial style massage. And every now and again, I would get someone coming back saying like, oh, I was like really sore for most of the week, but now I'm feeling pretty good. So it must be working. And my response to that was most of the time was, if you're sore for more than 2 or 3 days, that's my bad, because I've gone too hard. Like, I've overwhelmed your system in what we've been doing. It's normal to feel a little bit of discomfort while your body recalibrates or a little bit sore, but it shouldn't be like actually painful to move. Like, that's not right. So I'll keep that in mind as we go forward. I think the closest thing I've had in my practice so far was actually when someone stopped taking their herbs and started getting all these horrible symptoms. I was like, oh, that's funny. But if you don't want to take the herbs anymore, okay, that's cool. Interesting that they started when you stopped taking them and now you don't want to take them for fear that they'll make them worse again, even though they were helping. But okay. Honoring your experience. Yeah, thankfully I haven't had like too much of that. And the people that I have had who have the times when I have had people say, like, oh, I've been, like, I got a bit sick or a bit unwell, or they've described it. They've really, like, I've been quite apologetic about the fact that that's been a side effect of the treatment that we've done, or seems to have been. But they've often been like, no, I feel great now. It's felt like a purge, and I feel like I've cleared all this stuff out of my system. And like, well, I wanted it to be a lot more gentle than that, but I'm glad that you're okay with it. It wasn't really what I was going for. I didn't want you to be bathroom bound for 48 hours. That's not ideal. But as long as you're cool with it, then I guess it's not all bad. But yeah, it is very much something I try and avoid. I think probably from partially from being influenced by Claire so heavily over the last couple of years, but also I feel like the process of healing and going through the inherent discomfort of the human experience is already hard enough. And I don't really see the point in making it harder just for the sake of it being harder. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. Sometimes maybe that hardness can be the person believes that it's sort of validating. Like, I've been through some really tough stuff and now it feels like it's coming out, and that's horrendous on the way out, so it must be correct. And I get that. Sean Tootin shared a really helpful nugget, like doing, for example, bleeding the low channels. It's not pretty. Like, it's not Japanese acupuncture comfortable. It's and sometimes I'll share what he shared, which is like the pain came from the outside originally, and then the body wrapped up and made it go quiet. And it can be validating to the body or the body mind that there's pain on the surface again in this channel, which is where it came from, reminding the body that that's where it came from and it's on the way out. And most people really connect with that. They can get that. So I guess that, yeah, it's if we can bring that kind of validation in a more intentional way, where we're offering it in a, I guess, as in a more ritualistic way, maybe, for want of a better word, it's in a container instead of having that kind of chaotic feeling. But maybe I think also we just need to honour that patients come to us on their own trajectory, and they have their own meaning making around things. And sometimes if they're really ready to have something chaotic, we don't get to control everything in their life, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. What are they doing the other 163 hours of the week that they're not in our clinic?
Yeah.
We have no idea.
You're being sovereign beings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Living their lives.
Yep.
Yep. Being offered the same life lessons on repeat until they get it. What else, Lois? What else do you want to say to be able to tie it all off with a bow?
Oh. No pressure.
No pressure.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like a summary of, you know, to anyone listening, it's that being very tender with yourself and tender with your patients and what they're going through, and understanding that, like, as someone with an interest in this field and you're showing up in your student clinic or in your own practice, automatically you have a lot to offer people, and just to work with centering what that is, where you add value, and giving it sunshine and water and allowing it to grow, whatever that is. I think that's the best that any of us can do.
Beautiful words. Beautiful words. Thank you so much, Lois, for joining us today. And if people want to hear more from you, what are you offering?
That's a good question. I go through phases. So people in Sydney, I go through phases of doing practitioner play dates where we get together to do practical, like in student clinic where you practice on other people and talk about it. And I sometimes put things on my Patreon. I can do sessions with people over Zoom if they want to explore what body mind listening to body symptoms might look like. People are welcome to reach out and have a session online anywhere in the world. There's a Facebook group called Advanced. What's it called? Advanced Acupuncture Meeting Space, I think, that I co-host with Joanna Ashley. And anyone interested in that province is very welcome to join and connect there and explore. It's a nice, friendly place. Yeah, people can just connect with me at my website if they have questions. I love Chinese medicine and I love practitioners. I think, yeah, I'm just here for it.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you for being with us today. And thank you to our lovely listeners. As always, we appreciate you listening and we love to hear from you. Whether you love the episode, we'd love you to give us a 5-star rating on whatever platform you're listening to, and that helps to spread the word and also to make us feel good if you appreciate what we do. Until next time, that's it from us. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
Thank you, guys.